How we're going to talk about, do miracles occur? That is, do supernatural events occur in this space-time world? Many people believe that miracles are impossible. Others believe that miracles are incredible. Others believe that miracles are unidentifiable. There are many challenges to the question of miracles, and what we want to ask is a twofold question. Is there any legitimate philosophical objection to miracles? And two, is there any historical evidence for miracles, if we could answer the philosophical objections? Let's start our analysis of miracles with David Hume, the Scottish skeptic, who gave perhaps the most elaborate attack on miracles. And let's start with the first argument against miracles that was given by David Hume in his skepticism. It goes something like this. This is the argument that goes back to Spinoza. We'll get to David Hume's argument secondly. I'm sorry for the confusion. Spinoza was the pantheist who was a rationalist, and he said that natural laws are immutable. Now, in his day, in the 17th century, it was believed that natural laws, the laws of the physical universe, were immutable by many people. If natural laws are immutable and a miracle is a violation of a natural law, then, of course, it would be impossible for a miracle to occur. It doesn't take much thinking about Spinoza's particular argument to see that there are two things wrong with it. The first thing is that natural laws are not immutable. In Spinoza's day, it was believed that laws were prescriptions. It is now believed by scientists that natural laws are just descriptions, just maps. Now, maps are not immutable. Descriptions are not unchangeable. Scientists change their description as they get new information. So that Spinoza's argument against miracles is built on an outmoded view of natural law, what is called a closed universe, a universe that rules by rigid, immovable, eternal, fixed laws. That's not the kind of universe we have. We have an open universe, a universe more spontaneous, in which scientific descriptions are merely maps that outline the way the world does perform, not prescriptions saying the way it must perform. Secondly, Spinoza, on the minor premise where he says that miracles are violations of the law of nature, may be overstating the case. A miracle doesn't have to violate a natural law. He merely has to be a transcending of a natural law. For instance, when I take a magnet and pull a nail to it, I'm not violating the law of gravity, I'm just transcending the law of gravity. I have a higher power that is overpowering a lower power. So a miracle could be thought of more as a transcending of a natural law by a supernatural power rather than a violating of it, in which case the conclusion that Spinoza came to wouldn't follow. Now, secondly, let's turn to David Hume's argument. David Hume's argument is the one built on the credibility of miracles. Not that miracles are impossible, said David Hume, but they're just unbelievable. The wise man should never believe in them, and he should never believe in them for the following reason. A natural law is something that's highly probable. You stick a head under the water for 5 minutes, and the person drowns. You take the second person and do that, and he drowns. You line up 100 people, and all 100 will drown, and pretty soon you get the impression that it's highly probable that the 101st person will also drown if you stick his head under the water for 5 minutes. Now, you haven't put everybody's head under the water, so you can't say everybody will, but it's highly probable that everybody will. When you build a natural law about suffocation, a miracle, on the other hand, is built on the lowest degree of probability because they rarely happen. How many virgin births occur? Well, a number have been claimed, but the judge always threw the case out of court, and the person still had to pay the price. not many virgin births occur. You know, virgin births are very rare, 0.0001, whereas the natural law is 99.99 and going. Now, says Hume, if a miracle is based on the lowest degree of probability, and a natural law is based on the highest degree of probability, and thirdly, the wise man should always base his belief on the highest degree of probability. The wise man doesn't believe what's improbable. The wise man believes what's most probable. Scientists don't say, hey, it's highly probable there's a law of gravity, so I guess I won't believe in it. Then the conclusion, said Hume, is the wise man should never believe in miracles because it's always the lowest degree of probability. That seems to be a reasonable enough argument. And notice, number one, it's not an argument against the possibility of miracles, as Spinoza's was. This is an argument against the credibility or believability. Miracles might happen, but no wise man should ever believe it because the evidence is always going to be against it. In order to counter Hume, let me give you a couple illustrations. First illustration will be an illustration from the airplane. Suppose we go up in an airplane and we take a coin. Let's go over Chicago, a nice big city. And we take a little pencil and we go down to Madison Street and we draw a circle the size of a half a dollar on Madison Street in Chicago. Now we go up on a cloudy day, which would be almost any day, Chicago. We go up on a cloudy day and we throw the half a dollar out the window at random in the clouds over Chicago. What are the chances that half dollar will hit in that circle on Madison Street? Well, not very good, let's say. Highly improbable. The chances are 999, going against it happening. Now let's change the illustration. Let's go in the airplane, throw the half dollar out first before we draw a circle anywhere. Let the half dollar fall wherever it wants to fall. Then when the half a dollar falls, go up to it and draw a circle around the half dollar and pick the half dollar up and ask the same question. What are the chances that that half dollar would fall in that circle? They're exactly the same. Exactly the same chances in both cases. But it did happen. It did happen. Just because the odds against it are fantastic doesn't mean the evidence for it is not good. See, there's a difference between odds and evidence. The odds against a miracle happening based on other events, like everybody that's been born has not been born of a virgin, does that mean that the evidence for the virgin birth of Christ should not be heeded just because the evidence for everyone else being born is that they were born of a mother and a father? See, the wise man makes a different kind of conclusion than Hume. The wise man doesn't look at odds, he looks at evidence. The wise man doesn't look at probabilities for other event based on other events, he looks at probabilities for this event happening. What are the probabilities, or what is the evidence that this event happened? Well, is this really a coin? Is this really a circle? How many people do we have here to witness the event? Are they sober? Are they sane? Are they intelligent? That's the kind of evidence you need to know whether that coin is in that circle. Suppose you're playing bridge, or if you're a Christian, rook, and you're playing a little game of cards, and you deal a perfect bridge hand. What are the odds for getting a perfect bridge hand? The odds for getting a perfect bridge hand aren't very good. As a matter of fact, the odds for getting a perfect bridge hand are staggeringly low. Somebody has calculated the odds for a perfect bridge hand. He said the odds are 1 in 635 billion, 13,559,600. That's just for one of the four persons having a perfect bridge hand. 1 in 635 plus billion. So suppose we're having a friendly little bridge game some night, or rook, and somebody actually gets one. And you go to your skeptical friend and you say, hey, we got a perfect bridge hand. He says, I don't believe it. And you say, why? Because the odds against it are 635 billion to one. You say, but I was there, man. There were four witnesses. They were sober. They were sane. There was nobody cheating. They weren't, and there was no fooling around with the cards. It really happened. And your friend says, well, I'll believe the odds against it. And you say, well, I'll believe the evidence for it. Who's the wise man? The wise man is the one who believes the evidence for it, not the odds against it. And David Hume's argument is an argument built on odds rather than evidence. You shouldn't say, most people have died in the history of the world, therefore I'm sure Christ didn't rise from the dead. That's not a good argument. What you should do is say, what is the evidence that Christ rose from the dead? Might be poor, but you should still at least look at the evidence rather than looking at the odds built on the fact that everyone else has ever died. David Hume's argument is itself incredible because the most credible thing to do is to argue on the basis of evidence, not on the basis of improbability. Let me give you a third illustration. What are the probabilities that all of us, born where we were, from the families that we're all a part of, would be here in this room today at this time? What are the odds that we would all be here? Incredible odds against it. Incredible odds. Some of us are different national extractions. Some of us are different geographical locations. Some of us are different ages, different interests. And yet we're all here right now. The third argument is the argument that's given here from the standpoint of the identifiability of miracles. Can a miracle be identified? If it can't be identified, you can't use it to prove anything with. If I say, such and such is good evidence for the crime of so and so, and I could never identify such and such, could never be used in court. So if somebody says a miracle like the resurrection of Christ proves the deity of Christ, but you can never identify a miracle, you can never use it to prove anything. A man by the name of Flew has given this argument, he's a contemporary atheist philosopher, and in his article in the Encyclopedia of Philosophy and elsewhere on miracles, he argues this way. The unidentifiability of miracles is, one, a miracle would have to be either an exception to a natural law, in which case it would have to be supernatural, or it would have to be an unusual event in nature, in which case it wouldn't be supernatural. The only way to define or identify a miracle is by identifying it within the natural process, or as something apart from the natural process. Now let's take both alternatives. If you say a miracle is part of the natural process, it's no longer a miracle. You can't identify something that is natural from the natural. If you say a miracle is something that should be identified by the supernatural realm, you beg the question, because you're trying to prove that this is a miracle by assuming that miracles already occur. So either you identify a miracle within nature, it's no longer a miracle, or identify it by pointing to something beyond nature, but you can't do that because if there is something beyond nature, you've already supposed that the miraculous can occur in order to prove that miracles occur. Now the reason that Flew thinks that this is an impossible situation for the theist is because he is not allowing the credibility of what we've already done. Namely, we've already established that there's a supernatural realm. We've already established that God exists and there are good reasons for believing in God. This is what Lewis does in his book, Miracles. In the very first section, when he's arguing against naturalism, the naturalist says nature is the whole show. And Lewis says nature is not the whole show. There's something more than the natural world, namely the supernatural. Now, if I can establish that there's a more than, that God exists, and that nature is not the whole show, then I have something by which to compare and say, hey, there is what a miracle is. A miracle is a God-like event. A miracle is something that has the fingerprint of God. And I already know what God is like and what his fingerprints are like. Therefore, when I see a miracle, I see it has the fingerprints of God. I say, aha, God is in this. Now, what would the fingerprints of God be in this metaphor that I'm using? Suppose, for example, that we walk by a pond. And out of the pond, we see a muskrat rise. I used to trap muskrats. This comes to mind. And you see a muskrat rise out of the pond and it hovers in midair for 2 minutes. You hit your friend, you say, what's that? He says, a muskrat. What's it doing? Hovering in midair. There's nothing under it. And you have several witnesses that witness this, and then the muskrat plunks back into the pond, swims away. Was that a miracle? No. Might be just an anomaly. The scientists would call it an anomaly. What? Because you can't repeat it. Nobody knows of any other cases like that. It's highly unusual. Muskrats don't have wings. They can't fly. It's an anomaly. We don't know how to explain it. So just because it was highly unusual doesn't make it a miracle. The coin falling in the circle was highly unusual. All of us being in this room, highly unusual. We wouldn't cry miracle. Dealing a perfect bridge hand, we'd hardly call a miracle, would we? Highly unusual. There's got to be something else to it. Now let me give the something else that would qualify it as a miracle. Suppose that after we saw the muskrat flop back in the pond, we walk around the other side, and here's a large crowd. And there stands Billy Graham, and next to him, Madeline Murray O'Hare. And we discover that what just transpired a few moments before was this. Madeline Murray O'Hare says, there is no God. Billy Graham says, there is a God. Madeline Murray O'Hare says, well, prove it by doing something supernatural. Billy Graham says, would you believe there's a God if I pray and a muskrat rises out of this pond and hovers for 2 minutes in midair over this pond? Madeline Murray O'Hare says, if you can do that, I'll believe there's a God. And Billy Graham bows his head and he prays, God, vindicate yourself, prove that you're the true God. Let a muskrat rise out of this pond, hover in midair for 2 minutes. And a muskrat rises out of the pond and hovers in midair in 2 minutes, the very muskrat that we saw from the other side of the pond. Is that a miracle? Yes. Why? Because now we have a moral and theological dimension. Now we have a God context to it. It's not just an unusual event. It's an unusual event that came about by an unusual prediction. Anybody stands by a pond and says, I'll cause a muskrat to rise out of that pond and hover for 2 minutes in the air. That's an unusual prediction. It also had theological implications to it. There is a God. There is not a God. I don't know if you recognize it, but that's just a modern Mount Carmel illustration. Remember Elijah on Mount Carmel? The prophets of Baal? The prophets of Baal said, Jehovah is not God. Elijah said, Jehovah is God. He said, okay, put a sacrifice on the altar, and if fire comes down from heaven and consumes it, then God exists. So what we have to have for a miracle is, number one, highly unusual. But that's not enough. Number two, theological claim, moral confirmation, justification of a divine claim by an unusual act in the context of a moral universe where God exists. If God doesn't exist, miracles don't occur. But we've already established good reasons for believing God exists. Therefore, if a claim is made in the name of this God, an unusual event occurs as a result of a prediction that confirms and brings glory to him, then we have reason to believe it was a miracle. Can miracles be identified? Yeah. I can show you the fingerprints of God because I know what God's fingerprints are like. God is interested in truth. God is interested in goodness. God is interested in making the world work better. God is interested in things that bring good to man and glory to himself. Horizontal moral good, vertical theological praise. Those are two of the implicit things inside a miracle. We can identify a miracle. The resurrection would be a miracle. David Hume admitted, some of the most ardent atheists and skeptics who have ever lived have admitted what would constitute a miracle. I'll quote both Hume and Bertrand Russell. Hume said, if someone rises from the dead, that would be a miracle. Okay, we'll take him on that challenge and talk about the resurrection of Christ later. Bertrand Russell said in the Look magazine article, which he would call himself an agnostic, I think it was 1956, somebody said to him, under what conditions would you believe there's a God? He said something like this, if I heard a voice from heaven giving a series of predictions, and the series of predictions proceeded to come true one after another, then I would believe that God exists. Well, I might point out that this has already happened. A voice from heaven has spoken and given a series of predictions that did proceed to come true, and Bertrand Russell therefore ought to believe that God exists. So there are conditions, and all of those conditions are met in the biblical claim for miracles. This leads us to the next point, which is not on the board, that you can add to your notes, and that is the argument against miracles from causal agency. The argument against miracles from causal agency. There are those who are arguing, and this is a rather recent argument in the philosophical journals, that you cannot say God performed a miracle because there's no way to identify a connection between that event and God. Even if there were a God, and even if that were an unusual event, how do you know God did it? For instance, they say that if the Smoky Mountains from North Carolina were visibly transported through the air to Minnesota, and thousands of people saw them, that you could not call that a miracle. That if you saw the Smokies just rise in the air and fly to Minnesota and plunk down and stay in Minnesota, that no one could call it a miracle, because how do you know God did it? Might be a freak in nature, might be unusual. Why? Because, and here's how the argument goes, the only way we can identify an event with a rational agent, God, a rational agent causing the event, is if the event occurs regularly and repeatedly. Otherwise, it might not be the result of a rational agent. It might be a fluke if it doesn't occur regularly and repeatedly. When you see me do something over and over and over again, you can assume that I'm the cause of that. If I pick the book up again and again and again, over and over, I'm the cause. However, if you see someone pick up a book for the first time, you don't know he's the cause, because it might be a fluke, he might not be the causal agent, it might just be happening at the same time that his hand is moving, something else is picking it up, you don't really know. You can only make causal connections when the event is repeated. Concomitant variation, this is called in science. The principle of concomitant variation. Now let's analyze that argument. Events are known to be rationally caused only if they are repeated over and over. Miracles cannot be repeated over and over, therefore miracles cannot be known to be caused by a rational agent. A miracle doesn't occur over and over. You say, hey, run that virgin birth through again. I didn't see it. I'll repeat it over and over, and I'll believe God did it. Or how about, let's have an instant replay on the resurrection. We can instant replay the resurrection. Therefore, the resurrection can't count for any rational agent causing it. In response to this argument, let me point out the following. Suppose we were all standing there when former President Ford hit his hole in one. Remember, he had a hole-in-one a year or so ago. Suppose, and there were thousands of people there, I understand, at least hundreds of people standing there. And suppose we say, I don't believe a rational agent did that. Run it through again. Put the ball back on the tee and swing at it again, Ford, and then I'll believe that you caused that ball to go in that hole. You say, ridiculous. I mean, you saw him put the ball, you saw him swing, you saw the ball go through there, and it fell in the hole. We do know that things are rationally caused, that happen only once and can't be repeated. How do we know? Well, we had plenty of witnesses. We saw the causal connections, as it were. So it is not rational to say it has to be repeated over and over before an intelligent being could be doing it. God doesn't have to repeat a virgin birth over and over before, you know, he caused it. How do we know, then? We know by what C.S. Lewis calls fit. Does the miracle show purpose? Purpose indicates a rational agent. Does this purpose fit into this context? For example, a muskrat rising out of a pond, without Billy Graham, Madeline Murray O'Hara, and that whole story, muskrat rising out of a pond, is there any moral fit to that? No, no moral claim, no moral anything there, so it's not a miracle. But Billy Graham challenging her, true God, at stake, there's moral fit once you put Madeline Murray O'Hara, Billy Graham, and the claim that God exists into it. Now we have a context, and when the muskrat rises, it fits into that truth claim, miracle. Suppose I'm isolated out in the country, and my car won't start. My wife is sick, and I want to take her to the hospital. And I need one part for that car to get it going. And I'm isolated all the way out there in the country, and I don't have that part. My wife is dying, and I get on my knees by the car, and I say, God, please, I need this part to get this car going, to take my wife to the hospital. She's dying. For your glory and to honor your name, please give me this part. And I get up from my knees, and the part was, oh, let's say just a little bolt that I needed to get the car going. I get up from my knees, and I see a bolt out of the blue coming right down there, and it falls right by the car, and I pick up that bolt, and it's exactly the bolt I need to get that car going, and I get to the hospital and save my wife's life for the glory of God. Do I have a right to claim that a miracle? Yes. Why? Because it fits. It fits. That part fits not only physically, but morally into that context. It gave glory to God. There was something moral and theological about it. Now, it doesn't matter if the part fell off an airplane or not. It doesn't really matter if the part fell off an airplane. Because the Red Sea was caused by the blowing of a strong wind. It doesn't matter if God knocks a little bolt off an airplane on the way by or blows a little wind on the Red Sea. That's not important. What means he uses to accomplish it, the idea is it's an unusual event, right? Moral context in a world in which God exists and a truth claim is being made in the name of God. We can identify causal agency without repeated activity, just with purpose and fit. Now let's take a really big miracle, as someone very famous would say. Let's take the resurrection of Christ. Suppose for the moment that Christ really rose from the dead, and we'll get into that a little later. Suppose for the moment that Jesus predicted that he would rise from the dead, that he predicted that that would be a proof that he was God. And suppose that he really did rise from the dead. Would this be an indication that he was God? Well, it's surely unusual. So it's got the first characteristic of a miracle. Two, it was predicted, and it's a risky prediction. That's the second characteristic. Three, it has a truth claim or a moral context connected with it. It's about the true God. So all of these characteristics would fit the context of a miracle. It would have, as it were, the fingerprints of God on it, in the name of the true God, predicted, unusual, moral, and furthermore, brings good to the world. The world wants to reverse the course of death. The world wants to overcome mortality. The world wants eternal life. So if the resurrection of Christ occurred, it would be an example of a miracle. Did the resurrection of Christ occur? Is a question that we'll treat more fully later, but let me say very simply this. Philosophy can show that miracles are possible. Only history can show that miracles are actual. All of the arguments we've given you are just clearing the ground philosophically, saying miracles could happen. Whether a miracle has happened or not will depend on the facts. As a matter of fact, is the resurrection a miracle? As a matter of fact, did it occur? That's the same question. All I know is theoretically miracles are possible. How? Because every argument against miracles is one great big circle. Here's how the circle goes. Miracles cannot occur in the natural world because everything that occurs in the natural world is a natural event. I've heard sophisticated scientists argue that way. And I want to analyze for the remainder of our time the circularity of the argument against miracles. They are saying whatever happens in the world was caused naturally. C.S. Lewis in The God in the Dock has an article on miracles in which he gives the following illustration or something like it. He says, suppose you have 7 pennies, you stick them in your right pocket, and you take 3 pennies and you stick them in your right pocket. The laws of mathematics say you must have 10 pennies in your right pocket now, because the laws of mathematics say 7 plus 3 equals 10. But the laws of mathematics did not put the pennies in your pocket. Natural laws don't cause anything. Natural laws just describe what is being caused by something else. That's incredible when you think of it, but no natural law has ever caused anything. So for the naturalist to say, nature caused that, is really a cover-up, because what is a natural law? It's a description, and descriptions don't cause anything. Descriptions are just maps, outlines, sketches of what something else is causing. 7 plus 3 pennies in your pocket is described as 10 mathematically, but not put into your pocket, because math never put any pennies into any pocket. The first thing to say to a naturalist is, prove to me that nature causes anything. Natural law certainly doesn't, because natural law is just a description. Second thing is to show the circularity of the argument by the following. There are a couple people in the modern world who are arguing against miracles who give arguments exactly like this. Now, I'm just giving you a logical... His father continued to pray that he would be healed. His mother said, look, don't tell anybody. The kid's got a glass eye. They'll think you're nuts praying for a kid with a glass eye that he's going to see out of his glass eye. But his father prayed for 2.5 years, and so did a group of people. Now, that much of the story, they told me. The rest of the story I personally saw. David Pelletier came to Trinity, and he was in the chapel, and his father was there, and they covered up his right eye with a patch, because that's his good eye, and his left eye is a glass eye. One night, David Pelletier came bouncing out of the bedroom and said to his father, I can see with my bad eye, which is what he called his glass eye. So his father covered up his right eye, and he could see with his left eye. They took the glass eye out, and he could see. He had depth perception, and they took him to doctors. It's been verified by non-Christian doctors all around the world. No question, it's a medical fact. And I can give you the documentation for it. And no one denies it happened. No one who knows about it denies. I mean, non-Christians don't deny it happened. David Pelletier was in our chapel, and they covered up his right eye with a patch, and he picked things at random from the audience. And one ring I remember him reading off said University of Delaware off of one of the students' ring. They took his glass eye out, put it in the pocket, and opened the Bible, and he read from the Bible with the patch over his eye with his glass eye. He has depth perception. All of these things I verified for over 3 hours. Personally, David Pelletier. No question that David Pelletier sees. He even has x-ray vision, by the way, with his glass eye, with his left eye. That they don't play up because it's so scary. Okay, what do naturalists say about this? The kind of people I'm telling you, I can show you an article. I think I brought part of it with me, where a scientist looked at that, and what did he say? Praise God, a miracle. No, he didn't. He said this. He said, now we know you don't need eyes to see. Someday we'll be able to see out the end of our elbow and out the end of our finger. We know it's a natural event. Why did he say that? He said that because whatever happens in the world is automatically a natural event. His presupposition begs the question. His presupposition is, if it happens, we know it wasn't a miracle. If it happens, we know it wasn't a miracle. Well, you could never prove anything to someone like that. He has what philosophers call a blick. Now, a blick is, I've got my mind made up, don't confuse me with the facts. A blick is, I've got red glasses on, don't show me anything blue, because it'll look red to me. A blick is Luke 16:31. Neither would they believe, though one were raised from the dead. John Montgomery tells the following illustration of a psychotic patient who came to the psychiatrist, and he thought he was dead. That is, the patient thought he was dead, and the psychiatrist was trying to convince him that he wasn't really dead. He went through all sorts of things. Dead people don't talk. You can talk. Dead people don't walk. You can walk. Well, he thought that maybe dead people could do these things. Finally, the psychiatrist in desperation said to him, do dead people bleed? Oh, no, dead corpse cannot bleed. At which point, the psychiatrist took a pin, punctured his finger, and the blood came out the end of his finger, and the psychotic patient looked at his finger and he said, my God, dead people do bleed. Now, the point is, exactly the point of naturalism. You couldn't convince a naturalist that a miracle occurred if he stuck his finger right in Jesus' hand, or his hand right in Jesus' side, if that's the way he's going to be. But you see, that's not a reasonable scientific approach. A reasonable scientific approach is to take the same approach that scientists are now taking toward UFOs. Do they say, UFOs couldn't possibly be true? No, they want to look at the specific evidence for the specific event. Some people may be hallucinating. Some people may have too much to drink. Maybe some swamp gas here and there. Maybe the moon. But we want to look at all of the evidence for all, and some of them may be credible and some not. The same approach that is being taken to UFOs should be taken to the resurrection of Christ and to biblically claim miracles. We shouldn't rule them out in advance. We shouldn't say, couldn't possibly happen, or if it does happen, say, couldn't possibly be a miracle. Miracles are possible because God exists. If God exists, then acts of God can exist. And the only way you can disprove miracles is disprove God. Because unless you disprove God, then there might be a God around behind the scene who can act. And if God created the world, deism, then he can intervene in the world, theism. Because if he created the big miracle, something from nothing, he can create the little ones. I'm amused by the argument against miracles. Reminds me of the skeptic who said to the little girl on the sidewalk with her Bible, you don't believe that whole Bible and all those miracles, do you? She said, I do. And he said, well, how do you know it's true? She said, well, I just believe it's true. He said, you believe all those stories, like the one about Jonah, too, swallowed by the whale? You believe that miracle? And she said, I believe that Jonah was swallowed by the whale for 3 days and three nights. He said, well, how do you know that's true? And she thought a minute. She said, well, when I get to heaven, I'm going to ask Jonah. And the skeptic said to her, what if Jonah's not in heaven? He said, then you ask her. You heard the story about the man who was talking about the Red Sea, and he said, praise God, the Red Sea, Pharaoh drowned in this water, and God saved his people through the walls of water. And somebody said to him, that wasn't the Red Sea, that was the Reed Sea, and it was only about a foot deep, and the reason that the children of Israel could get through is it was only about a foot deep. And the guy said, praise God for another miracle, Pharaoh drowned in a foot of water. See, what is incredible about unbelief is that it takes a bigger miracle to disbelieve the miracles of the Bible than it does to believe some of the miracles of the Bible. Miracles are possible, and we'll talk, when we talk about who Jesus Christ is, whether a miracle has actually occurred.